Black Boy, Disc 10.
One summer morning, I stood at a sink in the rear of the factory, washing a pair of eyeglasses that had just come from the polishing machines, whose throbbing shook the floor upon which I stood. At each machine, a white man was bent forward, working intently. To my left, sunshine poured through a window, lighting up the rouge smears and making the factory look garish, violent, dangerous. It was nearing noon, and my mind was drifting toward my daily lunch of a hamburger and a bag of peanuts. It had been a routine day, a day more or less like the other days I had spent on the job as errand boy and washer of eyeglasses. I was at peace with the world, that is, at peace in the only way in which a black boy in the South can be at peace with a world of white men. Perhaps it was the mere sameness of the day that soon made it different from the other days. Maybe the white men who operated the machines felt bored with their dull, automatic tasks and hankered for some kind of excitement. Anyway, I presently heard footsteps behind me and turned my head. At my elbow stood a young white man, Mr. Olin, the immediate foreman under whom I worked. He was smiling and observing me as I cleaned emery dust from the eyeglasses.
"Boy, how's it going?" he asked.
"Oh, fine, sir," I answered with false heartiness, falling quickly into that nigger being a good-natured boy in the presence of a white man pattern, a pattern into which I could now slide easily, although I was wondering if he had any criticism to make of my work. He continued to hover wordlessly at my side. What did he want? It was unusual for him to stand there and watch me. I wanted to look at him, but was afraid to.
"Say, Richard, do you believe that I'm your friend?" he asked me.
The question was so loaded with danger that I could not reply at once. I scarcely knew Mr. Olin. My relationship to him had been the typical relationship of Negroes to Southern whites. He gave me orders, and I said, "Yes, sir," and obeyed them. Now, without warning, he was asking me if I thought that he was my friend, and I knew that all Southern white men fancied themselves as friends of niggers. While fishing for an answer that would say nothing, I smiled.
"I mean," he persisted, "do you think I'm your friend?"
"Well," I answered, skirting the vast racial chasm between us,
"I hope you are."
"I am," he said emphatically. I continued to work, wondering what motives were prompting him. Already apprehension was rising in me.
"I want to tell you something," he said.
"Yes, sir," I said.
"We don't want you to get hurt," he explained. "We like you around here. You act like a good boy."
"Yes, sir," I said. "What's wrong?"
"You don't deserve to get into trouble," he went on. "Have I done something that somebody doesn't like?" I asked, my mind frantically sweeping over all my past actions, weighing them in light of the way Southern white men thought Negroes should act.
"Well, I don't know," he said, and paused, letting his words sink meaningfully into my mind. He lit a cigarette.
"Do you know Harrison?"
He was referring to a Negro boy of about my own age who worked across the street for a rival optical house. Harrison and I knew each other casually, but there had never been the slightest trouble between us.
"Yes, sir," I said. "I know him." "Well, be careful," Mr. Olin said. "He's after you."
"After me? For what?"
"He's got a terrific grudge against you," the white man explained. "What have you done to him?"
The eyeglasses I was washing were forgotten. My eyes were upon Mr. Olin's face, trying to make out what he meant. Was this something serious? I did not trust the white man, and neither did I trust Harrison. Negroes who worked on jobs in the South were usually loyal to their white bosses.
They felt that that was the best way to ensure their jobs. Had Harrison felt that I had in some way jeopardized his job? Who was my friend? The white man or the black boy?
I haven't done anything to Harrison, I said.
Well, you better watch that nigger, Harrison, Mr. Olin said in a low, confidential tone. A little while ago, I went down to get a Coca-Cola, and Harrison was waiting for you at the door of the building with a knife. He asked me when you were coming down. Said he was going to get you. Said you called him a dirty name. Now, we don't want any fighting or bloodshed on the job.
I still doubted the white man, yet thought that perhaps Harrison had really interpreted something I had said as an insult.
I've got to see that boy and talk to him, I said, thinking out loud.
No, you'd better not, Mr. Olin said. You'd better let some of us white boys talk to him.
But how did this start? I asked, still doubting but half believing.
He just told me that he was going to get even with you, going to cut you and teach you a lesson, he said. But don't you worry. Let me handle this.
He patted my shoulder and went back to his machine. He was an important man in the factory, and I had always respected his word. He had the authority to order me to do this or that. Now, why would he joke with me? White men did not often joke with Negroes. Therefore, what he had said was serious. I was upset. We black boys worked long, hard hours for what few pennies we earned, and we were edgy and tense. Perhaps that crazy Harrison was really after me. My appetite was gone. I had to settle this thing. A white man had walked into my delicately balanced world and had tipped it, and I had to right it before I could feel safe. Yes, I would go directly to Harrison and ask what was the matter. What I had said that he resented. Harrison was black, and so was I. I would ignore the warning of the white man and talk face to face with a boy of my own color. At noon, I went across the street and found Harrison sitting on a box in the basement. He was eating lunch and reading a pulp magazine. As I approached him, he ran his hand into his pocket and looked at me with cold, watchful eyes.
"Say, Harrison, what's this all about?" I asked, standing cautiously 4 feet from him.
He looked at me a long time and didn't answer.
"I haven't done anything to you," I said.
"And I ain't got nothing against you," he mumbled, still watchful. "I don't bother nobody."
"But Mr. Olin said that you came over to the factory this morning, looking for me with a knife."
"Oh, no," he said, more at ease now. "I ain't been in your factory all day."
He hadn't looked at me as he spoke.
"Then what did Mr. Olin mean?" I asked. "I'm not angry with you."
"Shucks, I thought you was looking for me, to cut me," Harrison explained. "Mr. Olin, he came over here this morning and said you was going to kill me with a knife the moment you saw me. He said you was mad at me because I had insulted you. But I ain't said nothing about you."
He still had not looked at me. He rose.
"And I haven't said anything about you," I said.
Finally, he looked at me, and I felt better. We two black boys, each working for $10 a week, stood staring at each other, thinking, comparing the motives of the absent white man, each asking himself if he could believe the other.
"But why would Mr. Olin tell me things like that?" I asked.
Harrison dropped his head. He laid his sandwich aside.
I...
He stammered and pulled from his pocket a long, gleaming knife. It was already open.
"I was just waiting to see what you was gonna do to me."
I leaned weakly against a wall, feeling sick, my eyes upon the sharp steel blade of the knife.
You going to cut me? I asked.
If you had cut me, I was going to cut you first, he said. I ain't taking no chances.
Are you angry with me about something? I asked.
Man, I ain't mad at nobody, Harrison said uneasily.
I felt how close I had come to being slashed. Had I come suddenly upon Harrison, he would have thought I was trying to kill him, and he would have stabbed me, perhaps killed me. And what did it matter if one nigger killed another?
Look here, I said. Don't believe what Mr. Olin says.
I see now, Harrison said. He's playing a dirty trick on us.
He's trying to make us kill each other for nothing.
How come he want to do that? Harrison asked. I shook my head.
Harrison sat, but still played with the open knife. I began to doubt. Was he really angry with me? Was he waiting until I turned my back to stab me? I was in torture.
I suppose it's fun for white men to see niggers fight, I said, forcing a laugh.
But you might have killed me, Harrison said.
To white men, we're like dogs or cocks, I said.
I don't want to cut you, Harrison said.
And I don't want to cut you, I said.
Standing well out of each other's reach, we discussed the problem and decided that we would keep silent about our conference. We wouldn't let Mr. Olin know that we knew that he was egging us to fight. We agreed to ignore any further provocations. At 1 o'clock, I went back to the factory. Mr. Olin was waiting for me, his manner grave, his face serious.
Did you see that Harrison nigger? He asked.
No, sir, I lied.
Well, he still has that knife for you, he said.
Hate tightened in me, but I kept a dead face.
Did you buy a knife yet? He asked me.
No, sir, I answered.
You want to use mine? He asked. You've got to protect yourself, you know.
No, sir, I'm not afraid, I said.
Nigger, you're a fool, he spluttered. I thought you had some sense. Are you going to just let that nigger cut your heart out? His boss gave him a knife to use against you. Take this knife, nigger, and stop acting crazy.
I was afraid to look at him. If I had looked at him, I would have had to tell him to leave me alone, that I knew he was lying, that I knew he was no friend of mine, that I knew if anyone had thrust a knife through my heart, he would simply have laughed. But I said nothing. He was the boss, and he could fire me if he didn't like me. He laid an open knife on the edge of his workbench, about a foot from my hand. I had a fleeting urge to pick it up and give it to him, point first, in his chest. But I did nothing of the kind. I picked up the knife and put it into my pocket.
Now you're acting like a nigger with some sense, he said.
As I worked, Mr. Olin watched me from his machine. Later, when I passed him, he called me.
Now look here, boy, he began. We told that Harrison nigger to stay out of this building and leave you alone, see? But I can't protect you when you go home. If that nigger starts at you when you're on your way home, you stab him before he gets a chance to stab you, see?
I avoided looking at him and remained silent.
Suit yourself, nigger, Mr. Olin said. But don't say I didn't warn you.
I had to make my round of errands to deliver eyeglasses, and I stole a few minutes to run across the street to talk to Harrison. Harrison was sullen and bashful, wanting to trust me, but afraid. He told me that Mr. Olin had telephoned his boss and had told him to tell Harrison that I had planned to wait for him at the back entrance of the building at 6 o'clock and stab him. Harrison and I found it difficult to look at each other. We were upset and distrustful. We weren't really angry at each other. We knew that the idea of murder had been planted in each of us by the white men who employed us. We told ourselves again and again that we didn't agree with the white men. We urged ourselves to keep faith in each other. Yet there lingered deep down in each of us a suspicion that maybe one of us was trying to kill the other.
I'm not angry with you, Harrison, I said. I don't want to fight nobody, Harrison said bashfully.
But he kept his hand in his pocket on his knife. Each of us felt the same shame, felt how foolish and weak we were in the face of the domination of the whites.
I wish they'd leave us alone, I said.
Me too, Harrison said.
There are a million black boys like us to run errands, I said. They wouldn't care if we killed each other.
I know it, Harrison said.
Was he acting?
I couldn't believe in him.
We were toying with the idea of death, for no reason that stemmed from our own lives, but because the men who ruled us had thrust the idea into our minds. Each of us depended upon the whites for the bread we ate, and we actually trusted the whites more than we did each other. Yet there existed in us a longing to trust men of our own color. Again, Harrison and I parted, vowing not to be influenced by what our white boss men said to us. The game of egging Harrison and me to fight, to cut each other, kept up for a week. We were afraid to tell the white men that we didn't believe them, for that would have been tantamount to calling them liars, or risking an argument that might have ended in violence being directed against us. One morning, a few days later, Mr. Olin and a group of white men came to me and asked me if I was willing to settle my grudge with Harrison with gloves, according to boxing rules. I told them that, though I wasn't afraid of Harrison, I didn't want to fight him, and that I didn't know how to box. I could feel now that they knew I no longer believed them. When I left the factory that evening, Harrison yelled at me from down the block. I waited, and he ran toward me. Did he want to cut me? I backed away as he approached. We smiled uneasily and sheepishly at each other. We spoke haltingly, weighing our words.
Did they ask you to fight me with gloves? Harrison asked.
Yes, I told him, but I didn't agree.
Harrison's face became eager.
They want us to fight four rounds for $5 apiece, he said. Man, if I had $5, I could pay down on a suit. $5 is almost half a week's wages for me.
I don't want to, I said.
We won't hurt each other, he said.
But why do a thing like that for white men? To get that $5. I don't need $5 that much.
Oh, you're a fool, he said.
Then he smiled quickly. Now look here, I said. Maybe you are angry with me.
No, I'm not.
He shook his head vigorously.
I don't want to fight for white men. I'm no dog or rooster.
I was watching Harrison closely, and he was watching me closely. Did he really want to fight me for some reason of his own? Or was it the money? Harrison stared at me with puzzled eyes. He stepped toward me, and I stepped away. He smiled nervously.
I need that money, he said.
Nothing doing, I said. He walked off, wordlessly, with an air of anger. Maybe he will stab me now, I thought. I gotta watch that fool. For another week, the white men of both factories begged us to fight. They made up stories about what Harrison had said about me, and when they saw Harrison, they lied to him in the same way. Harrison and I were wary of each other whenever we met. We smiled and kept out of arm's reach, ashamed of ourselves and of each other. Again, Harrison called to me one evening as I was on my way home.
Come on and fight, he begged.
I don't want to, and quit asking me, I said in a voice louder and harder than I had intended. Harrison looked at me, and I watched him. Both of us still carried the knives that the white men had given us.
I want to make a payment on a suit of clothes with that $5, Harrison said. But those white men will be looking at us, laughing at us, I said.
What the hell? Harrison said. They look at you and laugh at you every day, nigga.
It was true, but I hated him for saying it. I ached to hit him in his mouth to hurt him.
What have we got to lose?
Harrison asked. I don't suppose we have anything to lose, I said.
Show, he said. Let's get the money. We don't care.
And now they know that we know what they tried to do to us, I said, hating myself for saying it. And they hate us for it.
Show,
Harrison said.
So let's get the money.
You can use $5, can't you? Yes.
Then let's fight for them.
I'd feel like a dog.
To them, both of us are dogs, he said.
Yes, I admitted. But again, I wanted to hit him.
Look, let's fool them white men, Harrison said. We won't hurt each other. We'll just pretend, see? We'll show them we ain't dumb as they think, see?
I don't know.
It's just exercise. 4 rounds for $5. You scared?
No.
Then come on and fight.
All right, I said. It's just exercise. I'll fight. Harrison was happy. I felt that it was all very foolish, but what the hell? I would go through with it, and that would be the end of it. But I still felt a vague anger that would not leave. When the white men in the factory heard that we had agreed to fight, their excitement knew no bounds. They offered to teach me new punches. Each morning they would tell me in whispers that Harrison was eating raw onions for strength. And, from Harrison, I heard that they told him I was eating raw meat for strength. They offered to buy me my meals each day, but I refused. I grew ashamed of what I had agreed to do and wanted to back out of the fight, but I was afraid that they would be angry if I tried to. I felt that if white men tried to persuade two black boys to stab each other for no reason, save their own pleasure, then it wouldn't be difficult for them to aim a wanton blow at a black boy in a fit of anger, in a passing mood of frustration. The fight took place one Saturday afternoon in the basement of a Main Street building. Each white man who attended the fight dropped his share of the pot into a hat that sat on the concrete floor. Only white men were allowed in the basement. No women or Negroes were admitted. Harrison and I were stripped to the waist. A bright electric bulb glowed over our heads. As the gloves were tied in my hands, I looked at Harrison and saw his eyes watching me. Would he keep his promise? Doubt made me nervous. We squared off, and at once I knew that I hadn't thought sufficiently about what I had bargained for. I couldn't pretend to fight. Neither Harrison nor I knew enough about boxing to deceive even a child for a moment. Now shame filled me. The white men were smoking and yelling obscenities at us.
Crush that nigger's nuts, nigger! Hit that nigger! Oh, fight, you goddamn niggers! Sock him in his fucking piece! Make him bleed!
I lashed out with a timid left. Harrison landed high on my head, and before I knew it, I had landed a hard right on Harrison's mouth, and blood came. Harrison shot a blow to my nose. The fight was on against our will. I felt trapped and ashamed. I lashed out even harder, and the harder I fought, the harder Harrison fought. Our plans and promises now meant nothing. We fought 4 hard rounds, stabbing, slugging, grunting, spitting, cursing, crying, bleeding. The shame and anger we felt for having allowed ourselves to be duped crept into our blows, and blood ran into our eyes, half blinding us. The hate we felt for the men whom we had tried to cheat went into the blows we threw at each other. The white men made the rounds last as long as 5 minutes.
and each of us was afraid to stop and ask for time, for fear of receiving a blow that would knock us out. When we were on the point of collapsing from exhaustion, they pulled us apart. I could not look at Harrison. I hated him, and I hated myself. I clutched my $5 in my fist and walked home. Harrison and I avoided each other after that, and we rarely spoke. The white men attempted to arrange other fights for us, but we had sense enough to refuse. I heard of other fights being staged between other black boys, and each time I heard those plans falling from the lips of the white men in the factory, I eased out of earshot. I felt that I had done something unclean, something for which I could never, properly, atone. Chapter 13. One morning, I arrived early at work and went into the bank lobby where the Negro porter was mopping. I stood at a counter and picked up the Memphis Commercial Appeal and began my free reading of the press. I came finally to the editorial page and saw an article dealing with one H. L. Mencken. I knew by hearsay that he was the editor of the American Mercury, but aside from that, I knew nothing about him. The article was a furious denunciation of Mencken, concluding with one hot, short sentence. Mencken is a fool. I wondered what on earth this Mencken had done to call down upon him the scorn of the South. The only people I had ever heard denounced in the South were Negroes, and this man was not a Negro. Then what ideas did Mencken hold that made a newspaper like the Commercial Appeal castigate him publicly? Undoubtedly, he must be advocating ideas that the South didn't like. Were there, then, people other than Negroes who criticized the South? I knew that during the Civil War, the South had hated Northern whites, but I hadn't encountered such hate during my life. Knowing no more of Mencken than I did at that moment, I felt a vague sympathy for him. Hadn't the South, which had assigned me the role of a non-man, cast at him its hardest words. Now, how could I find out about this Mencken? There was a huge library near the riverfront, but I knew that Negroes weren't allowed to patronize its shelves any more than they were the parks and playgrounds of the city. I had gone into the library several times to get books for the white men on the job. Which of them would now help me to get books? And how could I read them without causing concern to the white men with whom I worked? I had so far been successful in hiding my thoughts and feelings from them, but I knew that I would create hostility if I went about this business of reading in a clumsy way. I weighed the personalities of the men on the job. There was Don, a Jew, but I distrusted him. His position wasn't much better than mine, and I knew that he was uneasy and insecure. He'd always treated me in an offhand, bantering way that barely concealed his contempt. I was afraid to ask him to help me to get books. His frantic desire to demonstrate a racial solidarity with the whites against the Negroes might make him betray me. Then how about the boss? No, he was a Baptist, and I had the suspicion he wouldn't be quite able to comprehend why a black boy would want to read Mencken. There were other white men on the job whose attitudes showed clearly that they were cluxers or sympathizers, and they were out of the question. There remained only one man whose attitude didn't fit into an anti-Negro category, for I had heard the white men refer to him as a Pope lover. He was an Irish Catholic and was hated by the white Southerners. I knew that he read books, because I had got him volumes from the library several times. Since he, too, was an object of hatred, I felt that he might refuse me, but would hardly betray me. I hesitated, weighing and balancing the imponderable realities. One morning, I paused before the Catholic fellow's desk. "I want to ask you a favor," I whispered to him. "What is it?" "I want to read. I can't get books from the library."
I wonder if you'd let me use your card?
He looked at me suspiciously. My card is full most of the time, he said.
I see, I said, and waited, posing my question silently.
You're not trying to get me into trouble, are you, boy?
He asked, staring at me.
Oh, no, sir.
What book do you want?
A book by H.L. Mencken.
Which one?
I don't know. Has he written more than one?
He has written several.
I didn't know that.
What makes you want to read Mencken?
Oh, I just saw his name in the newspaper, I said.
It's good of you to want to read, he said, but you ought to read the right things.
I said nothing. Would he want to supervise my reading?
Let me think, he said. I'll figure out something.
I turned from him, and he called me back. He stared at me quizzically.
Richard, don't mention this to the other white men, he said.
I understand, I said. I won't say a word.
A few days later, he called me to him.
I've got a card in my wife's name, he said. Here's mine.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think you can manage it?
I'll manage fine, I said.
If they suspect you, you'll get in trouble, he said.
I'll write the same kind of notes to the library that you wrote when you sent me for books, I told him.
I'll sign your name.
He laughed.
Go ahead. Let me see what you get, he said.
That afternoon, I addressed myself to forging a note. Now, what were the names of books written by H.L. Mencken?
I didn't know any of them. I finally wrote what I thought would be a foolproof note.
Dear madam, will you please let this nigger boy...
I used the word nigger to make the librarian feel that I could not possibly be the author of the note.
Have some books by H.L. Mencken.
I forged the white man's name. I entered the library as I had always done when on errands for whites, but I felt that I would somehow slip up and betray myself. I doffed my hat, stood at a respectful distance from the desk, looked as unbookish as possible, and waited for the white patrons to be taken care of. When the desk was clear of people, I still waited. The white librarian looked at me.
What do you want, boy?
As though I didn't possess the power of speech, I stepped forward and simply handed her the forged note, not parting my lips.
What books by Mencken does he want?
She asked.
I don't know, ma'am, I said, avoiding her eyes.
Who gave you this card?
Mr. Falk, I said.
Where is he?
He's at work at the M Optical Company, I said. I've been in here for him before.
I remember, the woman said.
But he never wrote notes like this. Oh, God, she's suspicious. Perhaps she wouldn't let me have the books. If she had turned her back at that moment, I would have ducked out the door and never gone back. Then I thought of a bold idea. You can call him up, ma'am, I said, my heart pounding.
You're not using these books, are you?
She asked pointedly.
Oh, no, ma'am. I can't read.
I don't know what he wants by Mencken, she said under her breath.
I knew now that I had won. She was thinking of other things, and the race question had gone out of her mind. She went to the shelves. Once or twice she looked over her shoulder at me, as though she was still doubtful. Finally, she came forward with two books in her hand.
I'm sending him two books, she said. But tell Mr. Falk to come in next time, or send me the names of the books he wants. I don't know what he wants to read.
I said nothing. She stamped the card and handed me the books. Not daring to glance at them,
I went out of the library, fearing that the woman would call me back for further questioning. A block away from the library, I opened one of the books and read a title. A Book of Prefaces. I was nearing my 19th birthday, and I didn't know how to pronounce the word preface. I thumbed the pages and saw strange words and strange names. I shook my head, disappointed. I looked at the other book. It was called Prejudices. I knew what that word meant. I had heard it all my life. And right off, I was on guard against Mencken's books. Why would a man want to call a book prejudices? The word was so stained with all my memories of racial hate that I couldn't conceive of anybody using it for a title. Perhaps I had made a mistake about Mencken. A man who had prejudices must be wrong. When I showed the books to Mr. Falk, he looked at me and frowned. "That librarian might telephone you," I warned him. "That's all right," he said. "But when you're through reading those books, I want you to tell me what you get out of them." That night in my rented room, while letting the hot water run over my can of pork and beans in the sink, I opened A Book of Prefaces and began to read. I was jarred and shocked by the style, the clear, clean, sweeping sentences. Why did he write like that? And how did one write like that? I pictured the man as a raging demon, slashing with his pen, consumed with hate, denouncing everything American, extolling everything European or German, laughing at the weaknesses of people, mocking God, authority. What was this? I stood up, trying to realize what reality lay behind the meaning of the words. Yes, this man was fighting. Fighting with words. He was using words as a weapon, using them as one would use a club. Could words be weapons? Well, yes, for here they were. Then maybe, perhaps, I could use them as a weapon. No, it frightened me. I read on, and what amazed me was not what he said, but how on earth anybody had the courage to say it. Occasionally, I glanced up to reassure myself that I was alone in the room. Who were these men about whom Mencken was talking so passionately? Who was Anatole France, Joseph Conrad, Sinclair Lewis, Sherwood Anderson, Dostoevsky, George Moore, Tolstoy, Frank Harris, Mark Twain, Thomas Hardy, Arnold Bennett, Stephen Crane, Zola, Norris, Gorky, Bergson, Ibsen, Balzac, Bernard Shaw, Dumas, Poe, Thomas Mann, O. Henry, Dreiser, H. G. Wells, Gogol, T. S. Eliot, Gide, Baudelaire, Edgar Lee Masters, Stendhal, Turgenev, Huneker, Nietzsche, and scores of others. Were these men real? Did they exist, or had they existed? And how did one pronounce their names? I ran across many words whose meanings I didn't know, and I either looked them up in a dictionary, or before I had a chance to do that, encountered the word in a context that made its meaning clear. But what strange world was this? I concluded the book with the conviction that I had somehow overlooked something terribly important in life. I had once tried to write, had once reveled in feeling, had let my crude imagination roam, but the impulse to dream had been slowly beaten out of me by experience. Now, it surged up again, and I hungered for books, new ways of looking and seeing. It wasn't a matter of believing or disbelieving what I read, but of feeling something new, of being affected by something that made the look of the world different. As dawn broke, I ate my pork and beans, feeling dopey, sleepy. I went to work, but the mood of the book would not die. It lingered, coloring everything I saw, heard, did. I now felt that I knew what the white men were feeling. Merely because I had read a book that had spoken of how they lived and thought, I identified myself with that book. I felt vaguely guilty. Would I, filled with bookish notions, act in a manner that would make the whites dislike me. I forged more notes, and my trips to the library became frequent. Reading grew into a passion. My first serious novel was Sinclair Lewis's Main Street. It made me see my boss, Mr. Gerald, and identify him as an American type. I would smile when I saw him lugging his golf bags into the office. I had always felt a vast distance separating me from the boss, and now I felt closer to him, though still distant. I felt now that I knew him, that I could feel the very limits of his narrow life. And this had happened because I had read a novel about a mythical man called George F. Babbitt. The plots and stories in the novels didn't interest me so much as the point of view revealed. I gave myself over to each novel without reserve, without trying to criticize it. It was enough for me to see and feel something different. And for me, everything was something different. Reading was like a drug, a dope. The novels created moods in which I lived for days. But I couldn't conquer my sense of guilt, my feeling that the white men around me knew that I was changing, that I had begun to regard them differently. Whenever I brought a book to the job, I wrapped it in newspaper, a habit that was to persist for years in other cities and under other circumstances. But some of the white men pried into my packages when I was absent, and they questioned me. "Boy, what are you reading those books for?" "Oh, I don't know, sir." "That's deep stuff you're reading, boy." "I'm just killing time, sir." "You'll out of your brains if you don't watch out." I read Dreiser's Jenny Gerhardt and Sister Carrie, and they revived in me a vivid sense of my mother's suffering. I was overwhelmed. I grew silent, wondering about the life around me. It would have been impossible for me to have told anyone what I derived from these novels, for it was nothing less than a sense of life itself. All my life had shaped me for the realism, the naturalism of the modern novel, and I couldn't read enough of them. Steeped in new moods and ideas, I bought a ream of paper and tried to write, but nothing would come. Or what did come was flat beyond telling. I discovered that more than desire and feeling were necessary to write, and I dropped the idea. Yet I still wondered how it was possible to know people sufficiently to write about them. Could I ever learn about life and people? To me, with my vast ignorance, my Jim Crow station in life, it seemed a task impossible of achievement. I now knew what being a Negro meant. I could endure the hunger. I'd learned to live with hate. But to feel that there were feelings denied me, that the very breath of life itself was beyond my reach, that, more than anything else, hurt, wounded me. I had a new hunger. In buoying me up, reading also cast me down, made me see what was possible, what I had missed. My tension returned, new, terrible, bitter, surging, almost too great to be contained. I no longer felt that the world about me was hostile, killing. I knew it. A million times I asked myself what I could do to save myself, and there were no answers. I seemed forever condemned, ringed by walls. I didn't discuss my reading with Mr. Falk, who had lent me his library card. It would have meant talking about myself, and that would have been too painful. I smiled each day, fighting desperately to maintain my old behavior, to keep my disposition seemingly sunny. But some of the white men discerned that I had begun to brood.
"Wake up there, boy," Mr. Oland said one day.
"Sir," I answered, for the lack of a better word.
"You act like you've stolen something," he said.
I laughed, in the way I knew he expected me to laugh. But I resolved to be more conscious of myself, to watch my every act, to guard and hide the new knowledge that was dawning within me. If I went north,
would it be possible for me to build a new life then? But how could a man build a life upon vague, unformed yearnings? I wanted to write, and I didn't even know the English language. I bought English grammars and found them dull. I felt that I was getting a better sense of the language from novels than from grammars. I read hard, discarding a writer as soon as I felt that I had grasped his point of view. At night, the printed page stood before my eyes in sleep. Mrs. Moss, my landlady, asked me one Sunday morning,
"Son, what is this you keep on reading?"
"Oh, nothing, just novels."
"What you get out of them?"
"I'm just killing time," I said.
"I hope you know your own mind,"
she said in a tone which implied that she doubted if I had a mind. I knew of no Negroes who read the books I liked, and I wondered if any Negroes ever thought of them. I knew that there were Negro doctors, lawyers, newspapermen, but I never saw any of them. When I read a Negro newspaper, I never caught the faintest echo of my preoccupation in its pages. I felt trapped, and occasionally, for a few days, I would stop reading. But a vague hunger would come over me for books, books that opened up new avenues of feeling and seeing, and again, I would forge another note to the white librarian. Again, I would read and wonder, as only the naive and unlettered can read and wonder, feeling that I carried a secret, criminal burden about with me each day. That winter, my mother and brother came, and we set up housekeeping, buying furniture on the installment plan, being cheated, and yet knowing no way to avoid it. I began to eat warm food, and to my surprise, found that regular meals enabled me to read faster. I may have lived through many illnesses and survived them, never suspecting that I was ill. My brother obtained a job, and we began to save toward the trip north, plotting our time, setting tentative dates for departure. I told none of the white men on the job that I was planning to go north. I knew that the moment they felt I was thinking of the north, they would change toward me. It would have made them feel that I didn't like the life I was living, and because my life was completely conditioned by what they said or did, it would have been tantamount to challenging them. I could calculate my chances for life in the South as a Negro fairly clearly now. I could fight the Southern whites by organizing with other Negroes, as my grandfather had done, but I knew that I could never win that way. There were many whites, and there were but few blacks. They were strong, and we were weak. Outright black rebellion could never win. If I fought openly, I would die, and I did not want to die. News of lynchings were frequent. I could submit and live the life of a genial slave, but that was impossible. All of my life had shaped me to live by my own feelings and thoughts. I could make up to Bess and marry her and inherit the house, but that too would be the life of a slave. If I did that, I would crush to death something within me, and I would hate myself as much as I knew the whites already hated those who had submitted. Neither could I ever willingly present myself to be kicked, as Shorty had done. I would rather have died than do that. I could drain off my restlessness by fighting with Shorty and Harrison. I had seen many Negroes solve the problem of being black by transferring their hatred of themselves to others with a black skin and fighting them. I would have to be cold to do that, and I was not cold, and could never be. I could, of course, forget what I had read, thrust the whites out of my mind, forget them, and find release from anxiety and longing and sex and alcohol. But the memory of how my father had conducted himself made that course repugnant. If I didn't want others to violate my life, how could I voluntarily violate it myself? I had no hope whatever of being a professional man. Not only had I been so conditioned that I didn't desire it, but the fulfillment of such an ambition was beyond my capabilities.
Well-to-do Negroes lived in a world that was almost as alien to me as the world inhabited by whites. What then was there? I held my life in my mind, in my consciousness each day, feeling at times that I would stumble and drop it, spill it forever. My reading had created a vast sense of distance between me and the world in which I lived and tried to make a living, and that sense of distance was increasing each day. My days and nights were one long, quiet, continuously contained dream of terror, tension, and anxiety. I wondered how long I could bear it. Chapter 14. The accidental visit of Aunt Maggie to Memphis formed a practical basis for my planning to go north. Aunt Maggie's husband, the uncle, who had fled from Arkansas in the dead of night, had deserted her, and now she was casting about for a living. My mother, Aunt Maggie, my brother, and I held long conferences, speculating on the prospects of jobs and the cost of apartments in Chicago. And every time we conferred, we defeated ourselves. It was impossible for all four of us to go at once. We didn't have enough money. Finally, sheer wish and hope prevailed over common sense and facts. We discovered that if we waited until we were prepared to go, we would never leave. We would never amass enough money to see us through. We would have to gamble. We finally decided that Aunt Maggie and I would go first, even though it was winter, and prepare a place for my mother and brother. Why wait until next week or next month? If we were going, why not go at once? Next loomed the problem of leaving my job cleanly, smoothly, without arguments or scenes. How could I present the fact of leaving to my boss? Yes, I would pose as an innocent boy. I would tell him that my aunt was taking me and my paralyzed mother to Chicago. That would create in his mind the impression that I wasn't asserting my will. It would block any expression of dislike on his part for my act. I knew that Southern whites hated the idea of Negroes leaving to live in places where the racial atmosphere was different. It worked as I had planned. When I broke the news of my leaving 2 days before I left, I was afraid to tell it sooner for fear that I would create hostility on the part of the whites with whom I worked. The boss leaned back in his swivel chair and gave me the longest and most considerate look he had ever given me. "Chicago," he repeated softly. "Yes, sir." "Boy, you won't like it up there," he said. "Well, I have to go where my family is, sir," I said. The other white office workers paused in their tasks and listened. I grew self-conscious, tense. "It's cold up there," he said. "Yes, sir, they say it is," I said, keeping my voice in a neutral tone. He became conscious that I was watching him, and he looked away, laughing uneasily to cover his concern and dislike. "Now, boy," he said banteringly, "don't you go up there and fall into that lake." "Oh, no, sir," I said, smiling as though there existed the possibility of my falling accidentally into Lake Michigan. He was serious again, staring at me. I looked at the floor. "You think you'll do any better up there?" he asked. "I don't know, sir." "You seem to have been getting along all right down here," he said. "Oh, yes, sir. If it wasn't for my mother's going, I'd stay right here and work," I lied as earnestly as possible. "Well, why not stay? You can send her money," he suggested. He had trapped me. I knew that staying now would never do. I couldn't have controlled my relations with the whites if I had remained after having told them that I wanted to go north. "Well, I want to be with my mother, I said.
You want to be with your mother?
He repeated idly.
Well, Richard, we enjoyed having you with us.
And I enjoyed working here, I lied. There was silence. I stood awkwardly, then moved to the door. There was still silence. White faces were looking strangely at me. I went upstairs feeling like a criminal. The word soon spread through the factory, and the white men looked at me with new eyes. They came to me.
So you going north, huh?
Yes, sir. My family's taking me with them.
The north's no good for your people, boy.
I'll try to get along, sir.
Don't believe all the stories you hear about the north.
No, sir, I don't.
You'll come back here where your friends are.
Well, sir, I don't know.
How are you going to act up there?
Just like I act down here, sir.
Would you speak to a white girl up there?
Oh, no, sir. I'll act there just like I act here.
Oh, no, you won't. You'll change. Niggas change when they go north.
I wanted to tell him that I was going north precisely to change, but I didn't.
I'll be the same, I said, trying to indicate that I had no imagination whatever.
As I talked, I felt that I was acting out a dream. I didn't want to lie, yet I had to lie to conceal what I felt. A white censer was standing over me, and like dreams forming a curtain for the safety of sleep, so did my lies form a screen of safety for my living moments.
Boy, I bet you've been reading too many of them damn books.
Oh, no, sir. I made my last errand to the post office, put my bag away, washed my hands, and pulled on my cap. I shot a quick glance about the factory. Most of the men were working late. One or two looked up. Mr. Falk, to whom I had returned my library card, gave me a quick, secret smile. I walked to the elevator and rode down with Shorty.
You lucky bastard, he said bitterly.
Why do you say that?
You saved your goddamn money and now you're gone.
My problems are just starting, I said.
You'll never have any problems as hard as the ones you had here, he said.
I hope not, I said, but life is tricky.
Sometimes I get so goddamn mad I want to kill everybody, he spat in a rage.
You can leave, I said.
I'll never leave this goddamn South, he railed. I'm always saying I am, but I won't. I'm lazy. I like to sleep too goddamn much. I'll die here. Or maybe they'll kill me.
I stepped from the elevator into the street, half expecting someone to call me back and tell me that it was all a dream, that I was not leaving. This was the culture from which I sprang. This was the terror from which I fled.
This ends Disc 10.